All right, good morning. We're continuing the topic of Kavanah and Kriyat Shema, but I wanted to talk about, this will probably be the last one. I guess we can ask popular demand if there was interest in a second one. But we've talked about Kavanah in a few different ways so far. We've talked about Mitzvot Shichur Kavanah generally and comparing it. We've talked about, last week, for those who were here, we talked about Baruch Shem. Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuto Olam Ve'ed in its relationship to Shema. What I want to talk about today is the Gemara as a whole. We saw a few weeks ago lists out a number of debates about how much of Kriyat Shema needs Kavanah. What I want to do is I want to kind of just quickly go over that Gemara again, because what I want to point out is that not only are there a number of debates, and seemingly the Gemara says more than once halacha like this, but then halacha is like this about different positions, so what is the final psak? But the way that Kavanah plays out is that there's a number of different, permutations or cases where Kavanah matters. So I want to take a look at that Gemara and we'll see it. There's a Gemara here. There's also a Gemara at the end of the second parak. So that way we'll kind of be moving ground. We'll be able to skip a little bit later on Daf Tet Zayin. And there's a Gemara in Yuma as well. If you want to follow along, I'm going to read from the Gemara itself, but you can follow along if you want. I have a on the sheet, and then source number one, with also the English right below. You can also just follow along on the Gemara sheet. But the Gemara we saw, and this is the very beginning of Yigidim Amud Aleph, Tan Rabbanan, Shelo Yikral Mafreya, Advarim Alevavcha, Yachol Tehei Kol Parsha Kol Atzricha Kavana, Tamulomar Ha'ele, Adkan Tzricha Kavana. The Gemara quotes one view, Mikan Veilach Ein Tzricha Kavana De Rebbe Eliezer. Gemara quotes one view, Rebbe Eliezer, that how much of Kriyat Shema requires Kavana until the verse Ad Levavcha, that's what requires Kavana. From then on, you do not need Kavana. Amar Rebbe Akiva, Rebbe Akiva says no. Harehu Omer Asher Anochi Mitzavcha Yom Alevavcha, Mikan Shatolam Meche Kol Parsha Kula Tzricha Kavana. The Gemara says no. Rebbe Akiva's position is how much of Kriyat Shema requires Kavana. The entirety of the first parsha, meaning all of Shema and Ve'ahavta. And then the Gemara quotes, Amar Rabba Bar Rav Chana, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Halacha K'Rabbi Akiva. Meaning, what is the halacha like? This is Rabbi Akiva, which stated what? That Kriyat Shema, the Kavana is Me'akev, or is necessary Kriyat Shema, for the very first paragraph, meaning through Shema and Ve'ahavta. That's test case number one. I'm skipping a bit, the Gemara keeps discussing this. But skipping a little bit further down the page, just if you want to follow on the Gemara and the Gemara itself, it's Tan Rabbanan. It's the first medium size length wide line. Gemara says as follows: Tan Rabbanan, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, Ad Kan Tzricha Kavana Talev Divrei Rabbi Meir. The Gemara quotes the view of Rabbi Meir that how much of Kriyat Shema requires Kavana? Only the very first verse, the verse of Shema Yisrael. And then the Gemara says, Amar Rava Halacha. Rabbi Meir. Rava says the halacha follows Rabbi Meir's view, which is direct contradiction to the Gemara earlier had said that halacha is like Rabbi Akiva, who said that the whole first parsha requires Kavanah. Okay. The Gemara then continues. Has a little bit more. I'm skipping a little bit because I want to kind of move on. But the Gemara then continues a little bit later, and the next two dots, if you're following in the sheet on source number one or the English, it's just one after another, so you can just keep following there. If you want to follow here, it's the next two dots, so a few seconds later. The Gemara says as follows: Amar Rav Natan Bar Mar Ukva Amar Rav Yehuda. The Gemara says, still in the concept of Kavana, Al Levavcha Ba'amida. The Gemara says that, quotes the view of Rav Yehuda, that until the verse Al Levavcha, you have to say Be'amida, meaning you have to stand still. Meaning if you were walking, you were journeying somewhere, so you were saying Shema, you'd have to stop moving, and you stay still while you said Shema Yisrael, Ve'ahavta, and the second verse of Ve'hayu Advarim Ha'ele, until you reach Alevavcha. All of those three verses would have to be recited in standstill. Why? Seemingly because we need you to have a certain Kavanah. Because if you are moving, well, you know, if you're moving, you're active, you're less cognizant to what you're doing. So we need you to kind of stop, stay still, so that you can have Kavanah. The Gemara then quotes, though, the view of disagrees, the view of Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan said, no, how much needs to be said ba'amida? Rabbi Yochanan said, kol ha'parsha kula ba'amida, the entirety of the first paragraph. And the Gemara says, as the Rabbi Yochanan tameh, Rabbi Yochanan is consistent with the opinion we saw earlier, because Rabbi Yochanan earlier said that by kavana, how much of Kriyat Shema requires kavana? The whole first paragraph. So Rabbi Yochanan is consistent in saying that consistently you need to have kavana for the first paragraph. And I'm Rabbi Yochanan, Halach V'Acham, Shem Rabbi Yehuda, that indeed we have to have kavana for the whole first paragraph. The Gemara then continues, another instance of the same type of discussion about kavana. Tanu Rabbanan, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, Zu Kriyat Shema Shel Rabbi Yehuda Anasi. The Gemara continues and explains that Rabbi Yehuda Anasi would be teaching Gemara, he'd be teaching a shir, and he would stop the shir to recite one verse of Kriyat Shema, the very first verse, implying that almost, you know, this is the verse that's the critical part of Kriyat Shema. Everything else is maybe less necessary, maybe can be pushed off till later, but not as significant. The Gemara then continues, I'm skipping a bit more, and I want to go one more sugya here on this daf. The Gemara then follows, if you want to follow along the Gemara, it's like four lines from when the lines get wide. The Gemara says, five lines down, Amar Rabbi Elah, Bereder of Shmuel Bar Marta, Mishmei Derav. Amar Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, V'netnas B'sheina Yatza. What if you are said the word Shema Yisrael, and then you fall asleep? Right? Maybe you're just like so exhausted. I can easily imagine. We'll talk about this, what the case probably here is. Probably about nighttime. It's probably Shema Yisrael Mita. But honestly, the first time I read this, I actually thought it was talking about my high school days, where you'd come and you're so tired from the bus and you know, you'd fall asleep, and you'll notice that, like, the average high school boy in, like, these, like, schools, tachanun is very long. Well, everyone says a long tachanun. So I actually thought that's what it meant. You fall asleep in the middle of Shema first. But yeah, it probably is Shema Yisrael Amita. That's probably the real context here. But either way, if you fall asleep...
Shema in the morning.
What?
Well,
that would be the high school case. I think the case here probably is most... I think the halacha is still the same. The halacha is still the same, but I think the case here probably is about Shema Yisrael. It's probably Shema Yisrael Alamita when you're falling asleep.
Why don't we stand when we say Shema?
Why don't we stand? It's a debate in the first paragraph between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. Beit Hillel actually thinks that there's no need to stand. Beit Shammai thinks that... B'shach b'chov kumecha teaches you that b'shach b'chov you should be lying down, the kumecha means you should be standing. Beit Hillel says, no, it's just descriptive about time. But we did see, though, standing about standing still, and not moving forward. We did see that just a little bit earlier. Either way, the Gemara here has questions about sleeping, and the Gemara there says, how much do you need to be, someone has to wake you up to make sure that you say Shema. So the Gemara says, only the very first verse. If you said the very first verse, then even if you fell asleep at that point, we don't need to wake you up. You're what's called ones. At that point, you're exempt because you are out of your own capacities. You're asleep, so we're not going to have to wake you up. But if you hadn't yet said the first verse of Shema, you'd have to be woken up and forced awake. Okay. I'm going to summarize all these views again, but I want to kind of skip now to the next Gemara, the Gemara on Daf Ted Zayin Amud Aleph. If you want to follow, I did quote another one of these sheets, if you'd like to follow there, but you can also follow along source number 2. So the Gemara is there. The Mishnah had discussed a topic called Ha'umnin Korin Shema, discussion of workers. And if you are a worker, whether or not you have to stop working in order to recite Shema. And specifically, the Gemara's case had been, what if you are a worker who works at the top of trees, like you're harvesting trees or you're pruning trees. And you can imagine if you're standing on top of a tree, it's a rather distracting place to be reciting Shema because, you know, you have to be kind of focused on your balance. So you can't really have kavana. So the Gemara says, what do you have to do? Do you have to come down from the tree before saying Shema or not? So the Gemara at some point quotes the following debate. The Gemara says as follows, Rami Le Rav Mary Barader of Bat Shmuel the Rava. The following contradiction was quoted. Tanan, on the one hand, we have the Mishnah, which said, Ha'omnein korin brosha ilan brosha nidbach, Alma lo bai kavana. The Mishnah stated that workers can say Shema while reciting on the top of a tree or top of a wall, implying that you don't need kavana. But on the other hand, we have a bright that says, "Raminu akorit Shema sarech yichavenim libo." Shneimar Shema Yisrael uhalamana huamer haskate uShema Yisrael malehalan vaskate afkan vaskate. The Gemara quotes that there's another bright there which says that we have to have kavana for Kriyat Shema. So if Kriyat Shema does require kavana, how can you possibly suggest that the workers can stand on top of the tree and don't need to have kavana? So the Gemara asks, and it's worth noting who the Gemara's question is being posed to. Rav Meri is asking this question to who? He's asking it to Rava. Now, keep that in mind, because Rava, we saw earlier in the Gemara, we'll come back to this, but Rava, we saw earlier in the Gemara, had a different opinion. If the Gemara says, what's Rava's response to this question? Ishtik. Rava doesn't have an answer. Finally, the Gemara goes back and forth a little bit, and the Gemara finally concludes, Amar Lei, Lo Kasha, Habiperek Rishon, Habiperek Sheni. The difference is, what exactly part of Kriyat Shema are we talking about? If you're talking about the first paragraph of Kriyat Shema, then you need to have Kavana, and therefore you have to go down from the tree. If we're talking about the second paragraph or on, then you don't need to have Kavana, and you can keep reciting it from on top of the tree. Okay, so here we have another instance of Kavana discussion. Another question of how much of Kriyat Shema needs Kavana. Obviously, everyone agrees that you should have Kavana ideally for everything. But here we see that the delineating limit, or the line, is not the first verse, but once again, we see it being the first Parsha versus the second Parsha. And I've got one last Gemara, and this will be the last one, and I'll summarize to conclude everything, because I know there's a lot happening. But the one last Gemara, the Gemara in Yuma, quotes the following case. Source number 3. Amar Rabbi Zacharya ben Kabutel. The Gemara quotes the view of Rabbi Zacharya ben Kabutel. Man in la Rav Hanan bar Rav, lechia bar Rav kamei de Rav. Amar Rabbi Zacharya ben Kabutel. The Mechavelei Rav biyadei Kabutel. The Gemara quotes that they're quoting some type of story, some type of limud of Gemara, and at some point one guy's quoting the guy's opinion and says the guy's name is Rabbi Zacharya ben Kabutel. And the other guy, Rav, starts motioning with his hand and going, no, it's not Kabutel, it's Kabutel. It's a bet, not a pay. So the Gemara says, "Venemale Meimar." So why is it that Rav was motioning with his hand? Why didn't he just say it out loud? Because seemingly the story is that Rav kind of was motioning; he wasn't actually saying it, you know, verbally. So why not? Because Kriyat Shema Have Kari. Because Rav was in the middle of Kriyat Shema. So because he was in the middle of Kriyat Shema, he couldn't interrupt. He couldn't start speaking. So this is like kind of the equivalent of nowadays, like the challah. You know, you tell your dying what he said. So he's like, like meaning it's the wrong name. Fine. The Gemara says, "V'chi agavna mishari." What do you mean? So Rav is in the middle of Kriyat Shema. So then, how can you even motion? Even motioning is prohibited because, like Gemara says, "Amar Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Shmuel Bar Marta HaKriyat Shema Lo Yirmor Lo Yirmoz Beinav." If you're reading Shema, you're not allowed to signal with your eyes. Lo yikros b'sfototav. You're not allowed to signal with your lips. Lo yorah b'sfototav. You're not allowed to point. The whole point being that you have to be really confident in what you're doing. And if you, you know, indicate or point or some other thing, you're not really focused the same way. So the Gemara says, lo kasha. The Gemara ends the conclusion is, why was Rav able to motion that the name was incorrect? Because, habaperek rishon, habaperek sheni. Because the whole discussion about when you're allowed to motion or not to motion is about the first parak, meaning the first parsha of Shema and Ve'ahavta. If, though, you are reading the second parsha of the next paragraph or the third paragraph, then you do not need to have the same level of kavana, and you can indeed motion. That's the Gemara. I will mention, just as an aside, even within these positions, there are some further positions. The Meiri quotes a view, I'm not going to read this inside, but it's source 4, the Meiri quotes a view that says they need to have Kavana for all three Parshiot, not just the first Parsha, or the first verse, or the first three verses. There's also debate between Rashi and Tosfot, when Gemara talks about the first three verses. Does the first three verses mean the first two verses until the third verse? Or does it include the third verse, meaning until the beginning of the fourth verse? I'm happy to go through these details, but it's just more, you know, about this debate. I don't want to focus too much on that. Instead, I have a chart here. It's in Hebrew, but I will summarize it outside. What we saw was a number of different views. There are three different sugyot. There's the Gemara on Yud Gimel, Gemara on Tzayin, and the Gemara in Yuma, all of which talk about, ostensibly, Kavana. And we saw a few different permutations of where that discussion comes about. So we saw a discussion about Kavana in general, what's me'akev, what is necessary for Kavana to be yotzei the mitzvah. We saw discussions about Kavana when it comes to the question of standing still during Kriyat Shema. We saw a discussion about Kavana when it comes to being awoken when you're sleeping. We saw questions of Kavana if you are middle of teaching a shiur, how much of the shiur, you know, if you're middle of, how much of Kriyat Shema you have to say to be yotzei the chiyuv at that moment. We saw regarding Kriyat Shema if you're working, do you have a certain p'tur, how much of your exemption from working for Kavana is going to happen as well. And then finally, we just saw Gemara and Yuma about gesturing. How much can you gesture? When is gesturing a problem of Kavana during Kriyat Shema? Right? So these are different cases, but I hope everyone can see they're kind of like all under one clear rubric of issues of Kavana. And the big problem here is that not only is it one big issue, one thing of Kavana, but we have in effect a number of views. Now, having a number of views itself is not unusual. The Gemara does have debates. That does happen a lot. And so we saw views to the extent. We saw some views it has to be the first verse, maybe the first two or three verses, maybe the first parsha, or maybe the first two parshiot, or the first three parshiot. That exists. But what's perhaps more difficult is that the final conclusion of the Gemara seems to contradict itself a few different places. We saw that the Gemara on Yud Gimel quotes from the beginning a view about how much of Kriyat Shema requires Kavana. It quotes the view of Rabbi Akiva that the first Parsha requires Kavana, and Rabbi Yochanan says that's the way the Halacha paskent. But then, a little bit later, the Gemara says that actually Rava says we paskin that we require Kavana only for the first verse of Kriyat Shema. And then the Gemara comes back to the view of Rabbi Yochanan when it comes to the amount of standing, about standing still, and quotes Rabbi Yochanan, doesn't quote the dissenting view of Rava about only the first verse, and that seems to be stand that way. And then you have the Gemara in Antet Zayin and the Gemara in Yuma, where you have different cases, the case there of the workers, and the case of the gesturing, where the Gemara indicates that the differentiating line between what requires Kavana and doesn't require Kavana is going to be between the first Parsha and the next and the rest of it, the second and third Parshiot. Not, the Gemara does not mention the first Pasuk or the first three Psukim. None of those other distinctions we saw matter. The only one that seems to matter is the first Parsha versus the other two. And, sorry, I skipped the other thing on Yud Gimel. At the same time, you know, the other evidence is that we do have other cases where the Gemara seems to imply that the only thing that matters is the first verse. So when it comes to sleep, or when it comes to Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, when it comes to interrupting his Talmud Torah, we saw that the only thing that matters is the first verse. So what is it? Right? What's the way we paskin here? How do we interpret all these various cases that seem to contradict itself? Even, you know, how do we paskin at the end of the day? Anyone have any suggestions?
Levels, no? Like the same, you have different levels. So when you're anus, when you're not anus and you have time, then maybe all three verses are important. When you are anus, maybe less things. And when you're in a hurry, you know, maybe the first verse. When you're really, somebody's up to hit you or something like this, it's just the Shema Yisrael, the verses, and then you go up.
Yeah, maybe it could be there's some type of anus question of here, like how much time you have. But it'd be a little surprising, because some of these seem, like, it doesn't seem to fully work out, because some of these Gemaras, like, you still would expect the Gemara to mention that, like, it's only the first verse, then, like, gesturing, you know, is a good example of something where, like, you know, if you're anus, like, why can't you gesture then after the first pasuk? Why does the Gemara only mention
the first pasuk? Because gesture is less critical than the Kabbalah Torah.
Right, now they're teaching the Torah wrong. Oh, I think this is all one set, yeah. They're teaching the Torah wrong. They're quoting the wrong guy's name. I think pretty important to interrupt. I think you're certain. I think there might be something there, but I think there's something to. You have to debate a little bit some of the details here. But I agree, there's something there. Any other suggestions? Okay, so I want to quote effectively three different ways that Rishonim approach this sugya, and I think it's kind of interesting the way that they both approach it, as well as what it says about Kriyat Shema to begin with. So one view is the view of Tosfot. Tosfot, this is very much like a Tosfot-type question, right? This type of question about the fact that there's contradictions between one Gemara and another is a question that the Rishonim deal with a lot. Now, broadly speaking, there tends to be two main ways of interpreting these Gemaras, dealing with contradictions. One way of dealing with contradictions is a school of thought that's like the Gaonim, the Rif does it, and often the Rambam does it, which is, there is a contradiction, and what do? We paskin like one of the sides. Okay, there's a contradiction, the Gemara in Shabbos is this, Gemara in Brachot is this. We figure out which way we paskin, maybe there's certain rules, that in certain circumstances we're going to say this way, certain circumstances this way. We don't need to resolve the contradiction. At the end of the day, the contradiction exists, but the practice is going to be one way or another. That's one school of thought. Another school of thought, the school of thought that's usually Tosfot, and Ramban often follows this path as well, is a school of thought of, no, there are contradictions, but they need to be resolved. So what does Tosfot often do? Tosfot will suggest it's not really a contradiction. Instead, this Gemara is talking about this type of case, and this Gemara is talking about this type of case, but both Gemaras, in essence, they agree, they're just talking about slightly different cases. So even though the Gemara doesn't differentiate itself, there's no actual internal contradiction between the various Gemaras, and that way you can paskin, the halacha can follow in effect in both Gemaras. That's, broadly speaking, kind of the two different ways that Rishonim tend to deal with contradiction. Does this sound like vaguely familiar in terms of if you've learned some Gemara?
Just continue what Gemara is doing.
Yeah.
Gemara says this price is this, and we get to a point that
it's
an absurd case, that's why they don't want to conflict each other. So.
I mean, the Gemara itself does both of those solutions. Sometimes right. The Gemara says, you're right, it's a contradiction. It's two different Tanaim who have different, positions. And sometimes the Gemara says, no, really, Hachal
Ka'amar. When the sun was this position.
Yeah, exactly. So the Gemara itself does that same type of distinction. I mean, honestly, like, this is the way that, like... Yeah. So, in this case, you kind of have a similar distinction here as well, although actually all Shito tend to kind of... Because the problem is that, in this case, it's not just that there's a contradiction between different Dabim. Like, okay, the Gemara in Yuma, maybe you could say it maybe disagrees, the Gemara in Brachot, fine. The problem is that the Gemara in Brachot itself, on the same daf, right, seems to have these different opinions. So at some point, you're kind of stuck. Like, you can't just say, like, oh, it's different places, different opinions. You just postulate, like, one or the other. Like, you have to have some type of resolution.
Why?
Yeah,
why can't people disagree?
Because it's the same major sugya.
But is locality in the Gemara, meaning if it's not exactly the same sugya, and it's just, like, on the same page, but maybe it's, like, a different topic, like, does that mean that they were said, like, at the same time?
Well, the point is that the Gemara, the way that they're trying to read this is that, like, at some point, the Gemara itself, I mean, they're not talking about, like, from an academic perspective about when it is. I mean, if I was talking academically, I would say, like, when the Sevarayim put together the Gemara, whatever it is, the final text we have, at some point you're passing based on it. The larger topic is, like, in one concrete place. Like, you can't start differentiating between, like, oh, this Gemara doesn't have to necessarily engage with that Gemara like they do. They're direct conversation. It's not. I'm not putting in conversation. This is the conversation. They're on the same page.
They need to educate the people, so they have to come up with something, right? At the end of the day.
Yeah, that's true. That's always true. What I'm trying to say is that sometimes you can answer that, like, oh, you know what, like, maybe, like, they said one thing here, one thing there. We don't really necessarily have to, bring them together. This is, like, there's a whole school of philosophy here, a question of, do you have to always resolve contradictions? Do you have to think of, like, Hegelian, you have to be Hegelian and always deal with contradictions? Or are you okay with, you know, the fact that contradictions exist? In some ways, this is, like, the difference between Rav Kook and the Rav.
Isn't the issue, trying to figure out halacha lemaaseh?
Yes, for sure. But I mean, in terms of, like, how you deal with how do you get to halacha lemaaseh?
They ask the rabbi.
Well, how is the rabbi determining it?
That's his issue.
Yeah.
But also these days you have like Sfaradim do it one way, Ashkenazim do it another way. Other people, groups do it in different ways.
What I mean is more, obviously, Pesach itself, there's going to be different positions and different interpretations. What I mean to say is, when you're actually trying to figure out the Pesach, if you are the rabbi, how do you paskin? The way you deal with a contradiction when it's one place is not necessarily the same way you can deal with a contradiction when it's different places. You're just more limited.
You can't say this was in one context, this was another context, when they're in the same context.
Yeah, or you can't just say like they're not in conversation with each other. I can ignore one, which is
right,
the way that like some people say.
Or like, you know, just like Afronim differentiate between, you know, it's like on the same page but like different topics, and it's like the same discussion because like those could be.
Yeah, I think your question there about like where the limit is. So,
like,
if it's like two pages apart.
You know, it's clear, like, you know, they moved on to a new topic and then they come back to this topic, but it's like.
I agree. Really the line here is certainly, we can talk about this for a while, like where that line is. I think here it's pretty evident. Like,
okay,
this is one. Like, the Gemara even re-references the exact same Gemara beforehand.
Like, you know,
Korea
idea is like a whole thing and you do something else.
Yeah, I agree. And of course, like, we talked about the fact that there's going to be a contradiction with the Gemara later, and how do we deal with that? I agree, because the Gemara there certainly does
like
the front. The Gemara there like has like a whole sugya between.
Like,
yeah, but we can talk about this. Either way, that was all kind of just like a side point. But I meant to say, what are the answers? What are the positions here? So the first position is the answer that Tosfot suggests, and this is not just Tosfot, a few others, but Tosfot's probably the most common one, who argues.
Which one?
This is source 7 and 8. Tosfot argues that we have, in effect, the Gemara quotes a few different positions, and what is the most classic way the Gemara paskins? What's like one of the standard, most prominent rules about how we paskin? Is halacha kebatrai.
So,
halacha is like the last opinion.
So
in this case, who's the last opinion?
Rava.
Rava is the latest generation of the positions we saw. And so because Rava has that opinion, and Rava's opinion was that the only thing that matters is the first pasuk, so Tosfot says that's how we paskin. So then the question becomes, okay, but what about every other case where the Gemara seemed to imply it wasn't about the first pasuk? So Tosfot's answer is those Gemaras aren't explicitly stating every opinion, but in Achanami, Rava disagrees, and that the actual Pesach is like Rava in every single one of these cases. So, for instance, to take a look, for instance, at source number 8, Tosfot on the Gemara about the workers. Remember the workers, the Gemara says, how much do the workers have to have kavana for? The Gemara says the friendship between the first Parsha and the second Parsha. Tosfot there says, how the Perek Risha on source number 8, lav davka nakat Perek Aleph, he says, the Gemara said the first Parsha, but like, lav davka. The words aren't particularly precise. What it really meant was, you know, any one of the distinctions, way you differentiate. And here too, the way we actually end the paskening is like Rava's opinion, that what matters is the first pasuk versus the rest of Shema. And that's going to be true here as well when it comes to the workers. So one school of thought is that all of these sugyot are consistent. The Gemara itself might suggest otherwise, but that's just because it's not stating every one of the opinions. But if you are going to actually collate them all together, the only opinion that really matters at the end of the day is the position of Rava, that the only thing that matters for Kavana is the first verse. Everyone with me about that? Okay. There is a different view, the view of the Rif. Who is the Rif? When did he live? Anyone know?
Before the Rambam.
Before the Rambam,
before
yeah.
The Rambam.
He was the Rambam's father's teacher. Or the Rambam's, actually, sorry, the Rambam's teacher's teacher. He was the Rimigash's teacher. Who else was the Rif? Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi.
He was the first one that did the translation on the Mishnah, put it together, no? On
He went
Mishnah.
To the
Rambam.
And took out the Chalakim. He basically did the first thing, saying, this is the way we posture. Right?
Yeah, what the thing about the Rif is that the Rif, the Talmud is a book with a lot of discussion. The thing about the Rif is that he's the first person to kind of like extract from the Talmud,
yeah,
like, here are the main points. Here's like the first like clip notes of the Talmud. In the way that like the Gaonim, many of his positions are similar to the Gaonim positions, but the Gaonim don't have it as systematically. he's kind of systematic. Every single, you know, daf, like, I'm only going to include the part that we paskin like. What the Rambam did was then he kind of not only took what the Rif did, but then he reorganized it in, like, a more coherent manner. For the Rif, it's still kind of a mess because it's still based on the order of the Gemara, but it's, you know, he's only talking about the parts that we end up paskin like. So the Rif says as follows. The Rif says, L'divri Rabbi Yochanan, he disvirle debai kavana bikule pergerim. He's commenting on the part about the workers, that the workers, the Gemara differentiated between the first parsha and the second parsha. And he says all of this is true according to Rabbi Yochanan. The disvirle debai kavana bikule pergerim. Right, this is his position that we know. Anyways, he believes that it's all about the first parak versus the second parak. That's what he always consistently believes. Avale Rava, but Rava disagrees. Now, here's why I mentioned that it was important to remember the names. Remember, Rava is the position of the individual who said, we pass him like Rabbi Meir, on the Gemara Yud Gimel, that we pass him like Rabbi Meir, that only the first verse matters. However, on Daf Tet Zayin, when the Gemara about the workers, the Gemara quotes a contradiction. And who is asked about that contradiction? Do you guys remember who the Amoraim were in that discussion? If you'd like to look back at that Gemara, that discussion is between two Amoraim. The Amoraim are Rav Meri Bereder Bat Shmuel, who asks the question of Rava. Rava is in that conversation. And Rava is asked the question, and Rava, we're told, doesn't have an answer. And then the Gemara's conclusion, and seemingly Rava would appear to go along with that conclusion, is that the difference is between the first Parsha and the rest of Shema. Now that seems to be a big problem. It's one thing to say that the Gemara quotes a number of opinions, it's not always exhaustive, so we can say we're always passing like Rava. But it's another thing to say that Rava himself has an internal contradiction. How do you deal with that? How is it that Rava on Daf Yud Gimel seems to suggest that the psak is you need to have kavana for the first verse, and on Daf Tet Zayin he says you need to have kavana for the first parsha? Right, which one is it? So the Rif wants to suggest that actually there are two different types of concerns here. It's not just about Kavana. If you take a look back at the Gemara on in Yuma, I'm not going to read the Rif inside because I want to move on, but I want to look at the Gemara in Yuma inside. Take a look at the Gemara in Yuma, that's the source number 3, if you want to turn back there. Right, the Gemara in Yuma had talked about gesturing during davening. Right, can you gesture during davening or not? And Gemara said, you're allowed to gesture in effect during the second or third parsha, but not in the first parsha. What's wrong with gesturing? Why can't you gesture in Kriyat Shema?
Because it interferes with Kavana.
But it interferes with Kavana. Is there any other reason you can't gesture? Any other reason you can think of why gesturing would be problematic?
Disrespectful.
It's a little bit disrespectful. So take a look at the way that the Gemara seems to talk about it. The Gemara is not explicitly about this, but the Gemara continues. The Gemara continues and then talks about Tanu Rabbanan right after this Gemara. This is like 4 lines from the bottom of on source number 3. Tanu Rabbanan v'dibarta bam. The Gemara quotes me. I'm skipping a little bit. Rabbi Acha Omer. This is 3 lines from the bottom. Dibarta bam ase otan keva ve'al ta'asem arai. The pasuk by Shema says v'dibarta bam. Rabbi Shivtecha v'vetecha. You should speak these words. Rabbi Acha derives from here. You should speak about them. They should be keva and not arai. They should be significant or permanent. They shouldn't be some type of temporary or like ephemeral exercise. There should be something that's significant about this. And what the Rif wants to suggest is that this is really the core of what the problem is when it comes to gesturing, and he's going to argue it's also true when it comes to the workers. The problem is not about kavana. The problem is not about, you know, can I have the right intentions or not. The question is, when I am doing something else, when I'm engaged in some other activity, right, is it a little bit disrespectful? Is it, you know, I'm not really showing the level of concentration that I should be, you know, outwardly. It's almost equivalent of if I'm davening with my, you know, or I'm at a meeting and I'm texting during the meeting, or I'm at the shiur and I'm texting during the shiur. So, you know, it's very possible to listen well. You know, certainly we can talk about like, oh, your mind's in 2 different places, you're not listening as well. But I think if anyone's ever multitasked, and I assume every single person in this room has done it at some point, you know that in theory there are moments where you really could multitask well. But you can't deny the fact that ultimately, though, there is a certain level of disrespect. Like, it does not have the same... When you don't have the same clear focus, it, you know, there's a certain disrespect that's associated with it. It doesn't, you're not clearly giving it the same importance. And so, what the problem that Gemara suggests, or at least the way the Rif's reading it, is that the problem with in Gemara and Yuma, Gemara about gesturing, it's not necessarily about kavana. I could gesture, and maybe my kavana, you know, is not necessarily, it's not perfect, but it's not necessarily, you know, I can still have kavana. The problem is that I'm kind of, you know, demonstrating that this isn't as serious as it should be, right? It's middle, like, while having a conversation with the Kadosh Baruch Hu, I'm having a side conversation. I'm texting. I'm texting during davening. There's something that shows a little bit I'm not taking it as seriously as I should. And the Rif says that's true also when it comes to the case about the workers. That the workers, the problem there is that the workers are engaged in some task. Now, some tasks, I'm sure from everyone in their own jobs can know this, some tasks require a lot of, you know, concentration. You know, like me teaching this year, like I need to actually be fully engaged. But some parts of, you know, your job, whatever your job is, don't necessarily take so much mental focus, right? There are some parts of it that are almost rote because you've done it a million times, right? You know, you've just done it a million times. You know how to do it. You don't really need to be fully focused. But nonetheless, despite the fact you don't need to be fully focused, maybe, you know, if you're doing it at your desk, you would do it, maybe you can multitask, you could, you know, do something else at the same time. But if you're doing it in front of your boss, you probably wouldn't be multitasking, you know, so obviously, because you know, have to have a certain respect. Because it's what you want to show that you're doing the job properly. And so there's kind of the same thing here when the Rif argues when it comes to working, that the workers are engaged in something. Now, the Gemara's case is like the top of the tree or the top of the wall. It's not entirely clear exactly what work you're doing. But the Rif's one suggestion is that if you are saying Kriyat Shema while you're working, and I think we all know it's not so hard to say the word, especially like if you said it enough times in your life, the words are almost, you know them by heart. Like you can almost say them very rotely. So if you're saying Kriyat Shema while you're working, yes, you can say it accurately. Maybe you can even have some level of kavana. But if you are working, you're also engaged in something else. And so the Gemara is saying the first parsha requires a certain level of not just concentration, but a certain level of respect that the rest of it does not require. Yes, ideally, of course, you know, if you're in shul, I would say everyone should, you know, put your phones down for all of Kriyat Shema. But if you are working, the Rabbana and the rabbis made certain exemptions for workers who their day is very busy, they're on the clock. And so the rabbis made certain exemptions for workers in this particular case. That's the explanation of the Rif. Everyone, what do you guys think about that?
I have in mind, is a similar analog considered for soldiers? Because I also think about, like, you know, again, it's like one thing if you're a worker and you're, you know, kind of focusing on your job. I'm also thinking about, like, if you're a soldier, right? You can't, like, not focus on... You know.
But that's pikuach nefesh.
Well, that's the question. It's like, where,
well, interesting question. Where has soldiers come to? Let's come back to that. I want to go. I know Denny said 9:45. I want to go till 9:50. We start 5 minutes later, if that's okay.
All right.
Okay. Well, I'm just telling you if it makes a difference to your decision. Okay. I want to mention, before we move on to the third view, just briefly, there is a question to be asked here. Why is it that I can be respectful, that I have like a certain mandated respect for the first parsha of Kriyat Shema, according to this view of the Rif, but not the other two? Like, why is the first parsha more significant than the rest of it?
The third one is about Yetziat Mitzrayim.
So why? Yetziat Mitzrayim doesn't need respect?
Yeah, but it's not Kamalat Al Malchut Shamayim. It's a different...
Okay, what about the first? What about the second one?
The second one is about tzitzit, no?
No, the second one is about mitzvot.
Mitzvot.
Yeah, okay, but so is the end of the first one. Uksharta mlevot al yadecha, v'yutzvot peninecha, uchtavtam amzot peitecha, v'yisharecha. Those are mitzvot. They're also about mitzvot. So why does that require...
Kavana shel alev.
But this isn't about kavana. You think this is about arai. This is about whether it's keva or arai, whether it's I'm taking it seriously or not. So some people suggest, partially based on the distinction, that maybe this proves that the first parsha is Deoraita, and the rest of it is only Derabanan. I'm not sure that necessarily solves the problem, because why Derabanan? You don't need to have Kavanah, you don't need to have intent seriousness for Derabanan. Maybe not. There are two other answers. I'll just mention them briefly as kind of an aside point. The Ramban makes a suggestion that he quotes the Yerushalmi that says that, you may have noticed this yourself in your own davening, that what's the difference between the first and second parsha? And the Yerushalmi kind of gives these, like, that's what I'm saying, it's like almost like these clutch terrors. Like, they're not, they're effectively saying there is no real difference between the first parsha and the second parsha of Kriyat Shema. And so Rabban suggests, based on this Yerushalmi, that's why the rabbi said you don't need to have the same seriousness for the second parsha, because in effect it's just a review of the first parsha. So you already had your seriousness in the first parsha, so, like, you know, you're good enough for the second parsha. I mean, I'm sure we've all noticed, like, there are different themes, but they're pretty synonymous and similar to the first parsha. So that's the way the Ramban quotes, which is kind of funny.
We're also saying it's just realistic. Like, you're not going to have kavanah for all three
parsha. Well, this isn't about kavanah. This is here about just, like, not being distracted.
I'm saying you're going to be distracted for, like,
I don't know. I mean, maybe nowadays, like, we can't spend more than 6 seconds between the TV screen, you know, like the...
But, like, human nature hasn't changed that much.
I think concentration. I think not being, like, distracted on your phone, people could do for 2 minutes. I don't think it's so impossible, but... Not saying I have an easy time with it, but I don't think it's so impossible. There is a third view. I'll mention this, again, as an aside. There is the view of the Rashba, which the Rav actually has a whole essay, which is actually pretty similar to this, where he argues, effectively, that what we want you to do is we want you to kind of, like, establish a certain level of seriousness so that, yes, it's true, maybe you'll be distracted or less serious afterwards, but, like, once you kind of set the framework... then the rest of it, you know, kind of follows along. So yes, it's true that, you know, this might fit well with what you're saying, Boaz, that, you know, maybe, like, it's too hard to be off your phone for the whole 5 minutes, but, like, okay, so you're off your phone for the first minute, then, you know, the rest of it kind of still is, you know, ingrained within that larger framework. So you're kind of, like, demonstrating that seriousness, even if you're not carrying it through fully. That's another way of kind of...
Answer, I guess.
Yeah, it kind of has some more thing by creation. Yeah. So I think there's interesting questions about the framing that matters. This, like, kind of, like, takes it a whole different direction about the fact that it's not about kavanah, it's really about almost, like, creating the right framework, and the first pasuk or the first parsha creates the right framework.
Like, maybe if you're on the phone for, like, the beginning of Shema, then you won't remember to get off your phone for the rest of Shema.
Yeah, I want to quote one final view. This is the view of the Ravid. The Ravid, who is the Ravid?
Avad.
So there are actually three different Ravads, or there are actually three of them. The one we quote Ravid most commonly is the last one.
Who argues against the
Ravid. Who argues against the, and that one's pronounced usually the Ravid, because there's no second Aleph. That one's the...
Sorry, I didn't pronounce it the same way, is that just easily pronounce it?
I think it's called, I think they call it Rabad.
Yes.
I don't know. Maybe, but as opposed to some people are called the Rabad. Okay. Those are the first two. There's the Rabad 1, Rabad 2... It's confusing sometimes. But the most people care about if you've heard the Ravid before, you've probably heard of the third guy, the guy who comments on the Rambam. That's the main one. Either way, he has the following view, that he effectively splits the difference. He says that he actually wants to paskin that it's until out of the Vavcha, until the first three verses, that's when you need to have a certain level of kavana. Yeah, it's 14 and 15. He kind of splits the difference. And I want to just quote, actually, two different ways is kind of the difference is split. Because it's just interesting. The Rush quotes the view that even though it's true that you need to have Kavana just for the first verse, you do need to have, though, stand in one place for the first three verses, but not for the rest of it. Why not? Why is it that the fourth and fifth verse of Shema don't require you to stand in one place? Because you have this counter pressure of the fact that the fourth verse says, "B'shivtecha beveitecha uvelechtecha baderech." So if you are reading that I am saying Shema both when I'm sitting at home, but also when I'm walking, so that would seem to imply that I can walk during Kriyat Shema. So the Rush wants to argue that there's kind of like this counter pressure. On the one hand, yes, Shema should have a certain seriousness, standing in one place. On the other hand, though, clearly Shema also has this kind of the sense of, like, it goes along with your day-to-day life, and even if you're wherever you are, wherever you're moving, you can always say Shema, so you kind of have both these aspects. That's the way the Ravid...
But it doesn't work for the B'shachlecha, because we're not saying, when we say B'shachlecha v'kumecha, but actually we're midavening, we're saying Kriyat Shema, so we're not actually.
Yeah, because Beit Hillel, because Beit Hillel interprets B'Shavuach HaKamach about the time.
The time, right? So it's not have to be literally.
Yeah.
What,
yeah, you don't have to agree with the Ravid, but that's his position.
It's like the guy who's fixing the wagons. Like even when he's fixing his wagon, he's like.
Yeah. All right, very last view. You can go ahead. But very last view, the Rashba. You are dismissed. Very last view is the Rashba. The Rashba quotes also from the Ravid, although a slightly different version, although he's actually from Yisbon Gat, but it's a slightly different version. He wants to suggest that really it's all under, this might come back to what Chaim, what you were suggesting at the very beginning, it all might really be about Kavana. It's just a question of like how much Kavana and how distracting. Meaning, in the case of you are working. So you are working or you're trying to gesture, those are pretty distracting. So if you're gesturing or working, because it's so distracting, we're going to say you're going to need Kavana for the full first parsha. When it comes, though, to something which is a little bit less distracting, like walking, well, walking certainly can be distracting, but not necessarily as distracting. So once you've done the first three verses, at that point you kind of have enough Kavana so you can keep going, and you have enough for the rest. If, though, you're doing is you're sitting still, and you're, you know, you're in shul anyways, so then, as it is, your Kavana, you're not so distracted, so you really only need Kavana for the very first verse and not any of the rest of it. Mm-hmm. So that's the way that he differentiates. What I think, at the end of the day, we've seen a number of different views that kind of solve these kind of issues. We saw that, at the end of the day, Kavana comes up a number of different places. We sure don't have to deal with this big problem of how to deal with the contradiction. Someone suggests we always paskin Kavana is only necessary for the first pasuk. Someone differentiate between the cases, whether we're talking about concern only of Kavana or also maybe concerned about how serious it looks. Maybe we can make differentiations between the cases or like how much Kavana. And I think that all of these not only have interesting ramifications for how we paskin, but it also has kind of ramifications for how we see Shema. Is Shema in the very beginning about kind of, you know, really I do we should have Kavana for everything? Is it about kind of setting up the Kavana, the way that the Rashba seemed to quote about setting it up for the rest of it? Or is there like also this other value of also like being serious? That while you're saying Shema, yes, it's not only about, you know, having the right intentions, but of focusing, demonstrating to an outside observer that you really are taking this seriously and that you're fully within this conversation and not just, you know, multitasking. So I think this discussion kind of shares something about Kriyat Shema that I hope was enlightening. Mm-hmm. I'll take a question in a second, just if anybody does want to go. Unless many people want to continue with Kavana, there's a little bit more, but otherwise I want to move on. And next week we're going to start with, the Gemara has a discussion about Halal. And there's some interesting, there's a very fascinating Tosfot about Halal. Should you say Halal on Rosh Chodesh or not? So if you are interested in looking it up in advance, you can look at the Gemara in Yudalad and Aleph. There's a nice long Tosfot there about Halal and whether or not Halal should be recited on Rosh Chodesh or not. If you don't know what I'm talking about, then it'll be really interesting. You're looking at Minhagim, the Sephardim, I think, usually paskin that they don't say Halal on Rosh Chodesh, at least not with a bracha. So if you say a bracha, not say a bracha, we're going to talk about it. Should be interesting. Totally different topic.
Sephardim.
Yeah, we'll talk about it. There's like a few different issues here.
I can't believe I'm getting home.
I have a couple of questions. One